a student at McGill, and one of the memories of Montreal in the winter, when it's 20 below zero Fahrenheit, was in the middle of the snow, this bus would come on Pine Street, and they had flooded one of the open fields to make it a hockey rink. And the bus would stop, door would open, and all these little 3-foot-tall kids wearing helmets and a hockey stick would walk out. So this is the first thing I remember. So I know I'm back in Canada, so, and it's a pleasure to be. I want to discuss New Ekpyrotic Theory. It's hard to give a talk after Paul Steinhardt's beautiful talk this morning. This is, I guess, something a little bit different, as Paul was alluding to at the end of the talk. We are going to try something very different than inflation and see how far we can get with it. The work was done with Evgeny Buchbinder and Justin Khoury here. And it's got a long history. This New Ekpyrotic cosmology, which I'll describe shortly, simultaneously pieces of it, various different pieces, were done by Cremonelli and Senatore, and also significant parts of it by Lenners, McFadden, Turok, and Steinhardt. And a lot of that stuff was based on things that Neil Turok and his collaborators have been talking about for a long time. The original idea, I guess, preceded us with Gasparini and Veneziano, pre-Big Bang models. The idea that you might have had a universe before the Big Bang. You had some kind of Big Bang, and the universe then began to expand. And those models, I think, were very interesting. They had a great deal of difficulty getting the fluctuation spectrum to be realistic and so on. Ekpyrotic cosmology started with Justin, myself, and Paul Steinhardt and Neil Turok. And it had to do with M-theory. And we were looking at M-theory. It was very nice because in M-theory, using Horjava-Witten theory, you can actually get the standard model to live on one of the brains of M-theory. Not a trivial thing, because one of my pet peeves about cosmology is people often talk about cosmology in realistic terms in models that don't even contain any quarks or leptons, or if they do, they're nowhere near the standard models that we observe. So it's nice to actually be in a realistic setting. So heterotic M-theory was a realistic setting, and heterotic M-theory doesn't just have the brain on which we live, it has other brains in an interior, higher dimensional space. And the question arose during a conference in Cambridge a few years ago, is what would happen if these brains moved and collided with each other? Clearly, an enormous amount of energy would be implanted into the real world. Could this be the Big Bang? And that sort of launched the idea of ekpyrotic cosmology from the four of us. And we continued with that, and I think there was a lot of success with it, and there were also some problems with it. The success was you could compute the kinetic energy, you could compute the potential energy that would attract these brains to each other. These things tended to be negative exponentials, and we were surprised, or at least I was surprised to say the least, to find that you got a scale invariant spectrum when you actually roll down a negative exponential, steep exponential potential. So that was very, very interesting, and that's what launched this enterprise, really. The there were other successes of it. The problem with it is that when you do that, you simultaneously are in a space-time that is barely changing at all, but it, the extent that it does change, it is contracting. It's very slowly contracting. The duality of the situation is that the Hubble horizon is contracting quickly relative to a slowly contracting background. So this duality allows you to make physical sense of this, but there is this problem. The problem is you are in a slowly contracting space-time. And we live in an expanding space-time, so you have to go through a period of a bounce where you go from slow contraction through a bounce into an expansion. This requires you to violate the null energy condition, as I will discuss as we go along. And there are issues there when these when this happens. Do you have singularities? Are there ambiguities in whether the fluctuation spectrum will or will not go smoothly through this singularity and so on? there's been an enormous amount of work, particularly of Steinhardt and Turok with collaborators like Justin and others, to justify all of that, and that may very well be correct. And we're going to hear a lot of these things later on in this conference. However, there is this issue about what happens when you go through this singularity. We tried lots of things. We tried big crunch, big bang physics. We tried looking in higher dimensional boundary conditions. And these things may all, in fact, be correct. However, I always had this nagging feeling it would be really nice just to have a scenario that worked from A to Z without worrying about all the ultraviolet complications of it. So with that in mind, Evgeny and Justin and I proposed an effective four-dimensional approach to ekpyrotic theory, which we call new ekpyrotic cosmology, where we have absolutely no problems with any singularities, no ambiguities. You can follow this entire process through in an effective four-dimensional field theory from A to Z. And we'll see what problems may yet remain, but we feel that this gives a very simple, effective four-dimensional field theory describing ekpyrotic ideas. And so I need the hockey stick for this, I suppose. We've gone through all of these ideas. Of course, Neil and Paul continued looking at cyclic models, worrying about dark energy and so on. All of these, I still think, are very much in the realm of possibilities. But let me give you a scenario that just seems to work, a relatively simple scenario. So I need to discuss an ekpyrotic phase. There will be several phases of this theory, but let's look at the ekpyrotic phase. In its simplest language, we'll just look at a single real scalar field. We'll have a nice simple Lagrangian density where we have a canonical kinetic energy. I have no idea why that's still there. Actually, I do know why that's still there. And we have a potential, but this potential shows my facility with a computer. This potential, unlike what you will get in inflation, is in fact going to be negative. And in fact, the canonical example will be a steep exponential potential. So we'll define in terms of that potential an epsilon parameter and an eta parameter. And we will demand that these satisfy what we'll call a fast roll conditions, which for these particular definitions mean that epsilon and eta should be much, much less than one. And what this tells you is this potential is very steep and nearly exponential. So the canonical example is a steep exponential, though it need not be explicitly so. Oops. So for example, you can just simply take a negative exponential. We'll have this parameter p, which will make it steep enough. So p will be much, much less than 1. Epsilon is simply p over 2 in this language. And in this case, since it's exactly an exponential, this eta parameter actually vanishes. So the eta parameter is, in a sense, the way you drift away from pure exponential behavior. And we'll talk more about that as we go on. So during this phase, this ekpyrotic phase, we're starting with something very near zero potential. And then you are rolling very quickly down a steep exponential through this phase until it ends at some point, and then something else happens, which I will describe, and you will bounce and move into an expanding universe. So for this discussion, we'll just take FRW space, assuming that it's spatially flat, and then you have the usual Friedman equation, which we will see popping up over and over, and usual scalar equation. And you can solve this thing to give an exact scaling solution. And so you get a Hubble parameter as such. But the interesting thing is that since p is very, very small, you get a very slowly contracting spacetime. Now, one of the things about this that always irritates me to death is for some reason we decide time will go from minus infinity towards zero. So I guess that's what you guys do. So time is negative here. It's going towards zero. So this thing is actually contracting. But since p is so small, it contracts very slowly. So the Hubble parameter is really contracting. Hubble radius is contracting, but the space-time is barely moving, though it is slowly contracting. And then you have this solution for phi as well. So there's time going in the wrong direction, but that's all right. So what are the properties of this thing? Well, as I just said, A goes as t to the p, but p is very, very tiny. So this thing is contracting towards zero, but it's doing so very, very slowly. So it's approximately constant, if you like, which is a useful thing at given times. But it is contracting. It is an issue we have to deal with. What happens to the Hubble radius? Well, that thing is contracting, and there's no suppression of it. So it's contracting rather rapidly towards zero. So we have a decreasing Hubble radius. And again, in a sense, this word dual can have many, many meanings. But this meaning is that if you ask yourself, well, how does inflation work? You have a constant Hubble horizon, and the space is rapidly expanding outward relative to it. Here, the space is almost constant, but the Hubble parameter is collapsing quickly relative to it and allows you to solve a lot of the initial condition problems and so on in a very similar way. So what's the equation of state here? Well, you work it out, and you find it's given by this. Since p is very, very small, you get a very large omega. And that's the kind of thing Paul was alluding to at the end of his talk. And what does this mean? Well, if you compute all of the energy densities you can think of, you'll have an energy density just for the scalar phi. Goes as minus 2 over p. P is small, so that is a large result, and here's everything else for anisotropy, radiation, matter, whatever. And this guy coefficient is much, much larger. And since A is contracting, that means that this dominates as the universe contracts. So the scalar energy dominates, and you can forget all the other stuff. You're dealing with a problem with scalar energy, just like you would in inflation in the dual picture. So that's great. Question is, what are the density, scalar density perturbations that this thing would generate? And so working with this gauge invariant variable u, which is where phi is the Newtonian potential and the prime is the conformal time. Previously, I had regular time. You can get the Fourier modes of this thing, an equation for the Fourier modes given by this. Solution is a standard kind of thing, given in terms of these Hankel functions, where nu is this, all depending on p. Not easy to point with a hockey stick, you know? So if you look on large scales here, what is k squared doing now? Whatever. This is u sub something. In any case, the right-hand side is given by this. So you're attempting to be scale invariant, but the right-hand side, at least when p is very small, goes as minus 2p or minus 4 epsilon, if you like. So what you get is something slightly less than 1. You get a slight red tilt in this simplified model. And more generally, you can deform that exponential, as I said. It'll still remain steep because epsilon is small. It's not really exponential anymore. And the deformation away from that is codified in terms of eta. And eta can take either sign. So it can either make it more red or it can make it more blue. It just characterizes the deviation from it. So you can get any tilt you want by messing around with the kind of potential you're going to look at. So that's all very nice. And as I said, that was at least to me, rather amazing, because here is another kind of completely different potential with completely different physics, which will produce scalar fluctuations that are near scale invariant and can have a tilt that will map whatever the WMAP data is actually telling you that it is. But it has a problem. And at least at the level of this toy model, it has a problem. What you really want to do is look at curvature perturbations on these uniform density hypersurfaces. Yeah.
So in this model, where I'm kind of comparing this to inflation, that's why I have more intuition on that. So where is the process of quantum fluctuation become frozen, and where is the concept of horizon?
Yeah, so it's that dual picture. What happens is that you're getting quantum fluctuations, but the horizon is collapsing. So things are leaving the horizon and freezing. So instead of being created and pulled outside the horizon and freezing, they're being created and the horizon collapses around them and freezes. And then you have to go through the whole process at the other end, and the horizon begins to grow. Same story. It's a dual picture, and it's very nice how that works in a similar way. So the problem we have here is that if you go to the curvature perturbation, it is given by phi over a prime over a cubed, but the derivative of that with respect to conformal time. And the scaling solution, you find that phi actually goes as a prime over a cubed. So what happens is this time-dependent piece cancels top and bottom, but you differentiate it with respect to conformal time. So that at least, this is true for large modes, so at least at large, for large modes, large wavelengths, you find that you approach zero. So you get a very, very strong blue tilt here, which is not what you want in the curvature perturbations. So the question is what to do about that. Can you modify this in such a way that these curvature perturbations actually will have a Harrison-Zeldovich near scale invariant spectrum? And the answer to this, it's fairly easy to give an answer, though it is a little intricate, is that you introduce more fields. And we'll take the simplest example of several scalar fields. And here again, this is the kind of thing being discussed by a number of people, but certainly Neil Pirock talked about these things for a long time. This is the kind of thing you would expect in string theory, because you have moduli, and there are many moduli, usually too many. So you would expect to have more than one scalar field involved. So let's look at a Lagrangian density, a simple one, which is just normal kinetic energy for each, and then have the potential, some potential, which I will, for the sake of argument and definiteness, give as the sum of two potentials of that kind. So it's the sum of two potentials that look very similar to what I just discussed. And in both cases, they should be sufficiently steep. Now, I want to point out at the beginning, because it's important, that it has not been deeply explored by us yet, but this is a very fine-tuned thing to do. There's no reason why phi 1 and phi 2 can't mix with each other and have a very mixed kind of potential. And separating two exponentials is very fine-tuned. Furthermore, if you start modifying each exponential, that's less fine-tuned. But the fact is, you're still keeping phi 1 from interacting with phi 2. So in general, you really expect a big mess there where everything is interacting with everything else. That has its implications, which I'll come back to later. But for the moment, let's just consider this simple case. In a very nice paper, Koyama and Wands pointed out that phi 1 and phi 2 are just horrible variables to work with, that if you made these simple rotations to phi and chi, that the potential became something that was much easier to understand physically. And what that potential turns into is a steep exponential for phi variable. So this phi is going along and dropping off, just like we just saw. However, this is multiplied by the chi part of the potential, which is can be Taylor expanded out in terms of a constant. Then you get a mass term, and then a cubic term, and so on. I'll just look at the mass term for the moment. And the important thing about this mass term is its sign. So that, in fact, normally this thing would have a minus sign there, but as it is, because it's in a potential, but as it is, this is going to signal an instability. So I'll discuss that in a second. P1 and P2 are both, the sum of the two are both considered to be much less than 1, so this exponential is steep. And this chi is just some constant made up of all those horrible variables. And this v0 is another constant made up of all those horrible variables. And you can adjust them any way that you like. So that's what this thing looks like. You've got a phi direction and a chi minus chi t direction. And if the chi t bothers you, one can, without loss of generality, set it to 0, which I will do at some point. And let's look at the ekparotic phase. What's happening now is phi is going its merry way down its steep exponential before that ends. But while it's doing that, there's this chi direction. And in that chi direction, what you find is that you have a tachyonic mode because of that plus sign. Now, that tachyon mode is multiplied by that exponential out in front. So in fact, this gets larger and larger as you go here and gets more and more suppressed mass as you go backwards in time. So it starts out being relatively flat. And as you roll off, that curvature increases negatively. So you get a stronger and stronger tachyon behavior. Now, clearly, one has to discuss this kind of thing, because how on earth does one stay up on that ridge while rolling off? I must confess that when we first did this, prior to this Wands paper, it was not as clear to me that we were rolling down a ridge. Because if you look at those two exponentials, it's less than clear. But here you see obviously exactly what's happening to you, and we'll deal with that. Okay, so you have two equations. It's a phi equation, the usual thing, and a chi equation. And again, you get a scaling solution. The previous solution was an attractor. However, this is not an attractor solution because of the instability to roll off the side, which is important here, as we will see. So the solution is not unlike what we had before, very slowly contracting space. Hubble parameter of that. And in particular, chi is a constant. And that's important. What we're saying is that this solution is you're going right down the ridge. Of course, there's certain initial boundary conditions on this. And what we're doing is rolling right down the ridge and going down the end. And of course, that takes a lot of fine tuning, which we're going to have to discuss in the initial conditions. But let's just go with it for a while. So what is the properties of this thing? Well, nothing changes much. You have a slowly contracting space-time, as I just said. You have a decreasing Hubble radius. Hubble parameter grows. Omega is much bigger than 1 because p is small. And it so happens that v chi chi and v phi phi are the same. And that's important in what's going to happen here. And v phi phi, given by that exponential, is simply proportional to that. And then just for your enlightenment, this is an equation that we use constantly throughout everything that we do. And it's worth keeping it in mind. I'll bring it up a few times. Some of the expressions later on, you wonder where they come from. It's often the fact that this tachyon is related to h squared. I'm sorry?
Because p is small, right? So the last, if p is small, I think that the tachyon is much faster than the power.
I guess that's so. The m squared is much faster than it. What's the implication of that? We'll see. So what about density perturbations here? So before we were talking about a single scalar looking at its fluctuations. But here we're going to look at the fluctuations, the so-called entropy fluctuations of this chi mode. And again, this is a kind of thing, I guess this has arisen in curvitons. It was certainly in the work of Steinhardt and Turok, Lehner's, Vatten, and whatever. And this is what we did as well. And if you work out the density, the fluctuations in the chi direction, which should be v chi chi here, you get the usual kind of expression. However, if you go back to that previous property that said v chi chi is v phi phi was, goes as 1 over t squared, then, in fact, you will find that this thing will give you a near scale invariant spectrum again. The coefficient changes now somewhat, so it's almost one, but it is now up by 2p rather than down by it. This is for epsilon, if you wish. And so you get a slightly blue tilt coming out of this if nothing else is said about it. Of course, that's easy to change, and that's not an issue. Okay, so at this point, you say, fine, but we did these two exponentials that are added to each other. And I want to emphasize that that's extremely fine-tuned thing to do. It's hard to write a symmetry, a discrete symmetry, or anything else which would do that for you, at least as far as I know. So what we wanted to do was generalize the potential to see what happens if we look at more general potentials. It's much easier to do that, I think, in terms of these Wann's variables, phi and chi. So here's one. This isn't the most general generalization, but it's a large generalization. We take some v here, which needn't be an exponential. It merely should have a small epsilon and a small eta. So it's exponential-like, decaying very quickly. But it's got may have a non-vanishing eta, so it's not a pure exponential. Then I'll give this specific form here. I'll say why in a minute. You're allowed to have some function f as long as that is near 1. This should remain a constant. And there is an extra function f, which is all the higher chi cubed, chi fourth, all the higher polynomial terms or even non-polynomial terms in chi. And it can be completely arbitrary other than the fact that its second derivative should vanish at the top of the roll. And that's a pretty wide range of things you can write down. What am I leaving out? The thing that I want you to note is that this f and this little f have absolutely nothing to do with each other, and that will have a liberating effect on us as we go along. Now, this is constrained to some extent, note that, and that's chosen so that once again, v chi chi and v phi phi should be the same, and again, it goes approximately as 1 over t squared. We need that because that's exactly what's giving us the scale invariance in the chi entropy direction. And so we continue to use that. So this is a kind of most general thing. I don't know if I want to say most general. Most we could think of that continues to satisfy this and is otherwise pretty general. And f has to be near 1. So we took it to be 1 plus 3 delta. And I don't know why the 3 is there, but there was a reason. Delta could be phi dependent, but we took it to be a constant and much less than 1. And that will play an important role. So it's kind of what we were doing before, just more general. And the spectral index, if you work through all of that stuff, which is a lot of working, you find that the index changes now from 1. You can go up by 4 epsilon, but you can actually go down by minus 4 eta and minus 4 delta. So you can certainly easily get a red tilt if either eta and or delta are positive. And the delta you can just put in because it's just an arbitrary thing. The eta you'd have to shape your potential appropriately. So the claim is that you have a lot of flexibility there. And actually, you have much, much more. We're just dealing with a sort of the obvious extension of the two potential case. All right. So that's nice. We have the entropy perturbation being what we'd like. But you get the same issue. You like to convert this to the curvature perturbation. And the question is, can you do that? And what happens when you do? We saw that when we tried that for the single field case, that we got an incredibly blue tilt. And that was a problem. So what's going to happen here? So this is complicated, and luckily, at least one of my collaborators is in the room to answer any questions about it. But this is where life gets interesting. We've gotten to get to the end of the ekphorotic phase. and we have to get out of that phase. And there's a lot of issues to this, but there are several ways of getting out of that phase, and I'm sure you will hear from various talks here. One could imagine staying in that phase, ending it, but not really converting entropy perturbation yet. You could wait until you begin to bounce, just before the bounce, during the bounce, even after the bounce. And that's perfectly great physics, and it may well be that these alternative exit strategies are better than what I will show you here. We just wanted to get an idea in Newet Perotic theory of how this would work. So what we did was said, as you get near the bottom of the ekperotic phase, we just allowed the potential to tip, and tip sufficiently strongly that before the bounce phase, we would roll off the ridge, and phi would if you like, going from phi converts in the chi direction. And when you work that out, you find that if you turn rapidly from phi into the chi direction, and again, we're doing that just at the end of ekperotic phase, that the entropy perturbation, this delta chi that I showed you before, acts as a source for the curvature perturbations. And it does it in a relatively simple way. We actually did, or at least the thing I wrote down here, was an instantaneous approximation that all of a sudden it just dumps. You can solve it in a slower case and do it numerically, but this result is basically the fast roll-off approximation. This should be square root of E, but it doesn't matter. And so what you find is that the entropy perturbations source these curvature perturbations. This is the angular change in field space as you roll off, which is somewhere, it's not zero, and it's not 2 pi, so it's somewhere in between order pi, order 1, whatever. That actually could play a role in non-Gaussianity. I'll briefly mention that later. OK, so that's what we do. And therefore, you find that the curvature perturbations inherits a nearly scale invariant spectrum with this index. And it can certainly be slight red tilt if eta and or delta are not zero. So that problem seems to be solved. Now, as I said, there are many other exit strategies, and you'll hear some here. But this was the one we gave as an example. Then there are other problems. So let me continue with the list of problems that we hope we solve. During the ekperotic phase, you can look right out the energy densities for phi and chi, and they're given by this. Henceforth, I'm going to set the top of the ridge to be at chi equals 0, which you can do without loss of any generality at all. And so we want to look in this time interval between the beginning of the ekperotic phase and the end of it. Now, we want to be up near the top for a long time so that we will constantly be creating these entropy perturbations for, you know, maybe 60 E foldings. And we don't want to be rolling off from the top. And in order to keep that from happening, one has to constrain rho chi to be much, much less than rho phi, or at least less than it. And that will have its implications. In fact, here are its implications. It's actually easy to look at this one first. What is the example? What does that mean when you try to do that? Well, if this is dominant, then if you just plug it back in the Friedmann equation, it's proportional to H. And this guy, since it has very little kinetic energy, is dominated by this mass squared times chi squared. If you plug in that formula for the tachyon I gave you before, you will find that delta chi at the end of inflation ought to be P times M Planck. But that's another initial value problem, because you can show that this thing scales as h, so that if you ask what this is at the beginning, then it's the ratio of the h's. And since space-time is barely moving, you can cancel the little a factors there, and you find that you get an exponential suppression, where nek is the number of e foldings that have occurred during the ekpyrotic phase. So you find that you really need some pretty darn fine-tuned initial conditions. This thing is up near the Planck scale, but you have to be down by e to the minus nek, which is going to turn out to be, for 10 to the 15th reheating or something, this is going to be of order 60, as usual, 60 e foldings. So you have some very fine exponential suppression. That is, you have to be e to the minus 60 m Planck close to the top of the ridge in order for this to work long enough. That can be written in terms of the energy densities in that way, same story. So this really is an issue. And you could just see it right at the beginning. It's the Wands variables just showed this up beautifully. If you look at two exponentials, you might not notice this. I didn't. But if you look at the Wands variables, you're sitting on the top of a ridge, and you need, the thing that makes this work is this tachyonic instability, and you need to stay on there long enough so you get 60 e foldings of these fluctuations coming out of it. So if you work it out, you find that you've got some initial value problems that are not unlike, you know, the flatness problem or something like that of normal cosmology. However, we think that there are solutions to this which are not that hard. You may or may not agree. Let me show you one of them, which we thought was pretty good. We want to introduce a pre-ekpyrotic phase. Not surprisingly, I don't think the universe is going to start on the top of this ridge. So we're going to introduce a pre-ekpyrotic phase, which I'll try to make clear. It's pretty simple. We're going to use the potential we had before, but we're going to add a positive mass term for chi-squared, where this mass is phi-dependent. In fact, it'll get bigger for early times and get smaller for later times as it rolls along, not unlike hybrid inflation, frankly. And so the chi mass is given by this tachyonic mass plus something. And this is chosen that for large values of phi, that actually turns positive. So you're in a trough, if you like, in the pre-ekpyrotic phase. And for small values of phi, this thing goes away, and you go back to your tachyon. So it's a hybrid inflation kind of thing. And it's easy enough to write that down. And transition occurs where these guys become equal to each other. And remember that this tachyon, for the 12th time in this talk, I'll use this. This thing was proportional to h, you will recall. So what? So this is what it looks like. It's simple enough. Got this two-field model. You're rolling down here, steep exponential. Over here was this ekpyrotic phase with your tachyon, 60 e foldings, whatever number of e foldings you need, and working just fine. But when you get up to the top, you had to have it so close to the top. How is that possible? Here's how it's possible, because all of a sudden, the curvature goes up, and you find yourself being driven into the trough. And we'll analyze the physics of being driven into that trough. And you can see the potentiality of that. So here's our pre-ekpyrotic phase. It goes from time initial to time, the beginning of ekpyrotic phase, then to the ekpyrotic phase, then into some yet to be discussed phase thereafter. Yeah, so that's what I'll do now. So in general, no. You'd worry about the blue shift of the any kinetic energy you give it. So what we want to do, and I guess like these things or dislike these things, but I claim that they're harmless and easy, I want chi to couple to some very light fermions, psi. And they're very light to be massless at that stage. They become massive later on. And therefore, there's a decay rate into those things. You reheat. Which goes as the mass. And the mass of this guy is greater than the mass of this guy, which is given by that guy, which is, since P is small, it's much bigger than that. And we will assume that during this period that the energy density of phi still predominates, so we're H is decreasing. Time is getting smaller, H is increasing. So this is bigger than H at the beginning of inflation, which is a very mild condition. So what you learn is that this decay rate is much, much bigger than a Hubble time. And so you can just ignore blue shift of this thing due to contracting space-time. And you just get this rapid, this overdamped evolution of chi, which looks like that. So I don't know. Is there a god? Is there not a god? But throws a dart into the early universe, hits up here somewhere, some delta chi I, and starts rolling down, and you worry about it blue shifting, but it doesn't because it's radiating, 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 radiating. And it ends up in that trough, and let me estimate how close to the top of that trough it will go. We are imposing this constraint. Actually, this is very non-rigid. You don't really have to do that, but it gets too complicated to do it otherwise. So assuming this, then the first thing that you can show is that the energy density of chi and phi at the beginning of inflation is less than this exponential factor. The reason it's exponential now is this guy is decaying exponentially because it's radiating into these light particles. And this thing will satisfy all the conditions we need if h ek over I is bigger than or approximately the square root of 2 ek. So the pre-ekharotic phase, as I said, we're assuming it's phi dominated, so I can take h to be proportional to 1 over t again. You need not explicitly do that. But if you do that, you will find that the result is the ratio of the time, the initial time, and the beginning of ekpyrosis is given by this expression, greater than or approximately equal to that expression. And I can do less than or approximately equal in LaTeX, but I don't know how to do bigger than or approximately equal to, so it's become bigger than. And I know it's pathetic, but that's the way it is. If we take a typical reheating temperature later on, a 10 to the 15th JeV, this will translate into an ek of approximately 60. Same story. You're getting all of your Harrison-Zeldovich spectrum during ekpyrotic phase. If you have a high reheating temperature afterwards, that corresponds to having to have the 60 E foldings during the ekpyrotic phase. So that's what we'll do. So, yeah.
The horizon thing, you need 60 folds of AH on A. So is that what you mean by E folds here?
I'm sorry, say it again.
So to solve the horizon problem, you need 60 folds of AH, not A. And in this, in the W much greater than 1 models, A is not changing very much, right?
Yeah.
So for 60 E folds of AH, you haven't actually got many real
equals. Yeah, so
which one are you referring to?
Yeah, it gets a little mixed, but at the end of the day, because I haven't described to you, and I won't in this talk, how you go through, after the bounce, how you're going to go through to reheating and so on. But you will have to get a Hubble parameter to be, you know, sufficient size for the horizon problem. And it turns out that that's related to the horizon at the end of the ekpyrotic phase. And that's then related to this n ek, puts n ek to be the same as n at, during radiation-dominated space afterwards. So it's a bit of a story, but that's how it goes. So the claim here is, well, in order to satisfy the conditions we wanted to satisfy before, we find that the initial time has to be only of order of the factor of 100 before ekpyrotic, the beginning of ekpyrotic phase. So, you know, that's nice. It means I didn't have to start, you know, 10 to the 14th times the time of the beginning phase. You just have to start a factor of 100 before it, which seems okay. But better yet, let's look at delta chi. here's delta chi at the begin, at the initial delta chi. It's given by that using similar logic to what I've used. And if I insert that expression I had before, I will find that delta chi at the beginning has to be given by this expression. Once again, 10 to the 15th GeV and eq approximately 60 and p of an order of about 1/100th, which is a typical value for p. We find that the initial value of hi, in order to be exponentially close to the top of the ridge at the beginning of inflation, all this has to be is 10 to the minus 4 mp. So we don't really have to fine tune where God throws this initial dart. It can be pretty close to the Planck scale, down by 10 to the minus 4. And then it will damp quickly enough that it will get to within the right bound to give us 60 E foldings during the ekphorotic phase. So it's pretty nice. Now, the one thing, so pre-ekphorotic phase, I think, really does remove exponential fine tuning. And there may be many other ways to do this kind of thing, but it seems like a very simple way of solving that problem. Now, you might worry about what happened to the massless fermions. But what happens is that after you roll off the side, chi gets a vacuum expectation value, which is pretty large. And therefore, those fermions get a vacuum expectation value, which puts them up above the gut scale. So they actually become heavy later in the process, so you don't have to worry about them. So this seems like a nice and simple thing. None of this would we claim, you know, has to be how nature works. But they seem like very reasonable models. And we think that this shows that that problem is not as bad as it looks. Yeah.
Big conceptual question. So two slides ago, you have this decay rate for chi. And the decay rate, I understand it in Kafka space. But then you have this horizon scale fluctuation in the chi field, or super horizon scale. And could you use the same decay rate for this super horizon or super Hubble chi fluctuations that you would for Minkowski space fluctuations?
Well, I think, I mean, space is, that's a good question. I'm not sure how to answer you. I think so, because what would I say to you? I'm a little confused by the question. Let me.
Okay, you're asking because it's an FRW, whether we can.
Yeah.
Precisely because gamma is so much bigger than Hubble.
But I'm saying if you have a fluctuation which is much larger than your local Hubble radius.
Yeah.
And can you talk about the decay of that the same way you do it for the Minkowski fluctuation? Because, I mean, locally, chi looks homogeneous to me. Mm-hmm. So.
The answer is we'd have to look to make sure that we, I think so, because we worried about all these things, but I'm not, at the top of my head, I can't answer you right away.
You have a look. If you use the tree at parallel phase to put it right on the top, and but as soon as it enters the ekphorotic phase, you have quantum fluctuations.
Yeah.
Those quantum fluctuations might bring you down.
Yeah, but they don't. That's all those bounds. They will last there for 60 E foldings before you substantially roll off.
But the mass of the tachyonic chi is much bigger than H.
Those quantum fluctuations are what we amplify to get.
Well, the quantum fluctuations are given by H.
No?
The amplitude of quantum fluctuations. Given by H.
So you're asking delta chi?
Yeah.
It's smaller.
Yeah, smaller, right? But
the mass is exponentially small.
Also exponentially small?
Yeah, because it's multiplied by this exponential factor in front of it. Remember that mass. So it's tiny. It's exponentially small. Right, because that mass was in a 1 plus a minus mass squared, but it has an exponential, decaying exponential in front of it. So it's suppressed. I think that's okay. So I think this is okay, and I won't worry about that, which we really did worry about. It looks very fine-tuned. I don't think it is. I think you can easily come up with scenarios, simple ones like this, that'll solve that problem. Now comes the reason we really did all of this. The only problem with early ekphorotic theory was can we really go through a bounce? Does it have a singularity? Are the boundary conditions ambiguous, and so on? And as I said, my guess and my hope is that that can, in fact, be understood and will be OK. However, we intended to take an exact end run around that and try to just give a simple four-dimensional effective field theory scenario where it all works, and I don't have to worry about that. That's what new ephorotic theory is. That comes in right here when we talk about the bounce phase. During the pre-ephorotic phase, space is contracting, so H is less than zero. This goes back to Paul's talk, the end of Paul's talk, all of these discussions. We have to bounce to an expanding space where H is greater than zero, so we must pass through a bouncing phase where H dot becomes greater than zero. And in general, we know that we get the H dot equation will be minus a half rho plus p. And for normal matter, rho plus p is greater than or equal to zero. And that is the null energy condition. So in order to have a bounce phase, we have to violate the null energy condition. And I guess if I had a thesis to this talk, it would be right here. As you will see later, and then in Evgeny's talk later, ekparotic theory, as we've known for a while, tends to produce very large non-zero three-point non-Gaussianity. Let us say that is confirmed. Then one is getting oneself in a position where maybe the real important physics is to find out how you consistently violate the null energy condition, either in field theory and or in M-theory, string theory. That's a really interesting question. So let us give you an example, okay, which may not be the final word on this. So we got to violate the neck, and that requires omega to be less than 1. We're taking this beautiful work of the Harvard group, Arkani Hamed and many others, Cremonelli and Ludi, and leading people out. It's Nicholas. Let's look at a real scalar field. I'll do a simple case. The energy density that you take, you define normal. Here's the normal kinetic energy term. We'll make it dimensionless by dividing it by some mass to the fourth. And once it's dimensionless, I can take any function of it I like. I'll call that function p. And we'll multiply it by m to the fourth to give it the right dimensions. It's got this equation of motion. And that has a solution when you take the derivative of x to be 0. So what you assume is that two mass scales, and they are different. Now, what happens here is you assume that this thing has a minimum, which it need not. For instance, if you look at DBI inflation, where you get this kind of thing, unfortunately, it doesn't have a minimum, at least not as it originally stands. So you need to assume that there is a minimum. That's quite an assumption, and that the minimum is not at 0. Then you can always scale that point at which it's not at 0 to a half. And then the solution is simply minus m squared t, where you remember that people take time to be negative. Okay? This is a Ghost condensate. And it's a really, to me, very smart idea. Because what it's telling you is you have a vacuum expectation value of this field. But unlike all the vacuum expectation values we've ever dealt with in our life, this one changes in time. Why not? The beauty of it is that the fluctuations around that time-dependent vacuum expectation value have positive energy. There's no ghosts there. And that's a really smart idea, just really smart. OK, now if you do this, you get omega equals minus 1. It turns out that to get omega less than 1, you have to add a potential, albeit one that's relatively flat. I'll quickly go through this stuff. If you add that, you find that you can expand around this is called a ghost condensate. And you expand around the ghost condensate. You get an equation for it, which you can solve. You find that the energy density is V. The pressure is minus V. So that's the usual this plus this. Those cancel. That's the usual problem. However, this turns out to be proportional to minus pi dot. And if pi dot is positive, this will be negative. If pi dot is zero, it'll be zero, and if it's negative, that'll turn positive. So in fact, you can get null energy condition zero or null energy violating, depending on the dynamics of pi, and I'll show you that in a minute. So that's what allows you to violate the null energy condition when pi zero dot is greater than zero. And that's really very, very clever. So we'll take for an example a potential. This isn't terribly important. I will run on to the important things. And the kind of thing that happens, we'll look up here. We're not combining this yet with ekphorosis, but we will in a minute. Ekphorosis is out there. Here you come up, you find that pi dot is negative, so you have the null energy condition. But it goes zero at some point, and then it becomes positive. And in this region, you're violating the null energy condition. And that really happens, and we've solved these equations, you know, numerically. That's what happens, okay? If I look down here at h versus time, which is going the other way, we start off here with h dot negative, but we hit this point, and h dot is zero, and then it goes positive for a while. So it's really very nice, and all of a sudden h dot goes to zero, and all of a sudden h is positive, and you've bounced, and then you come out the other side. It's important to note that the size, absolute value of h here and here turn out to be the same. That's related to the question that Andrew was asking before, but I don't have time for that today. So let's take that and merge it with ekphorosis. I'll put the potential up here, and I'll put that function for kinetic energy down here. So we start off rolling down this ekphorotic phase. You go faster and faster, x gets bigger and bigger, you roll out here. We'll ask that this p of x be more or less linear out here so that we can use the linear kinetic energy that we did previously. You don't have to, but that's the simplest thing to do. Now, all of a sudden, you hit this wall here that we're now going to add to this thing. So this is the new part. And when you add that, all of a sudden, within a Hubble time, you find that the velocity slows down tremendously. So this falls down this way. And then it rolls over the top and goes into the neck violating phase. And at that stage, you're sitting just to the left of this condensate phase. And during this time, the universe is bouncing. And we've done this in explicit models, several of them, numerically, and it merges. There are various conditions. Let me just say, you get, you know, various conditions you need for the bounce. And that's where you get these two mass scales come in. One of them is relatively small. One of them is order gut scale. But this works fine. So let me get toward the end of this talk. That's the basic scenario. And as far as we know, that basic scenario works. It's a scenario. We don't want to push it farther than it should be pushed. I hope that it has the kind of ultraviolet completions that Paul and Neil and Justin and I originally thought. May well. But it's nice to know that there is this effective low energy theory that does this so well. So that's great. We have to be careful. So recently, there was a paper of Linde et al. Who questioned whether these theories, not just ours, but ghost condensation in general, might have ghosts. And I wanted to address that here, because I think that's important. I don't think that there's a problem here. On the other hand, it leads to interesting opportunities. So let's just see what those are. Remember, here's our Lagrangian. We have P of x. We have a potential. That's what x is. And what we're going to do now is we've already looked at the classical solution, if you like, the condensate plus pi zero, which led us through the bounce. And now we're going to allow for small xt-dependent fluctuations around that vacuum, using the fact that p vanishes at the minimum, which I said we could scale to be a half, which you can. And calling K the mass at the bottom, the whatever you want to call it, the kinetic energy mass at the bottom of this T function. Then you can expand this out, and a lot of stuff vanishes and screws around. And if you look at the quadratic, well, the quadratic pieces here, you'll find that pi dot squared is just more or less is canonical, though it has a coefficient out in front. And you get a grad phi squared piece here, which comes with a pi zero dot. The part that would come canonically with the minus grad phi squared vanishes because it is proportional to p of x. So you have to work through all of this, and you realize that you're breaking Lorentz invariance. Very important point. So because this condensate is time dependent, you're breaking Lorentz invariance in it. And that shows itself in the fact that when you expand around it, you don't get a Lorentz invariance box phi squared. Box phi squared. It's wrong again. Phi box phi Lagrangian. You actually lose the grad phi squared piece, but you do pick it up at next order where it's multiplied by pi zero dot. So then what? Well, we know we had this h dot equation, which is proportional to rho plus p, which is given by this, and I'm not sure, no, there's no minus sign, this is correct. You can then solve for exactly this factor, it's given by that. You take it and you plug it in. So you work out a dispersion relation for this, and what do you find? You find that omega squared is now equal to, if that were all there was to that Lagrangian, it would be minus 2 times h dot. And that would be great as long as h dot was negative, which is what it usually is in a neck conserving world. But in the neck violating phase, as I have said, it is positive. And that leads to an instability here with that minus sign where omega wants to tunnel. And we call that a gradient instability. There's a similar genes instability, which is better known, which I won't discuss here. This is the issue. So what are we going to do to get rid of that? Now, I don't know about this. This only lasts for an incredibly short period of time, one or two Hubble times. I'm not sure I should worry. But if I were to worry, there is a way that was introduced initially by other people, Criminelli et al., which is to add higher dimension operator. After all, this term, this Lagrangian, is not expected to live in a vacuum. We know that there's a high momentum theory. This is just the low momentum effective limit. When you decouple a heavier theory, ultraviolet theory, to a low momentum theory, you get the low momentum theory plus an infinite series of operators in higher and higher dimension. So if you take a gut theory, expand around a vacuum expectation value, and decouple it to the standard model, you don't really get the standard model. You get the standard model plus terms proportional to p squared over m squared, p to the fourth over m to the fourth, p to the sixth. So the decoupling theorem says if you go towards zero energy and you ignore all of that, you get the standard model. However, even in grand unified theories, people look at higher dimension operators, as I'm about to do. For instance, nucleon decay, if you took the strict decoupling limit, you would be no nucleon decay at low energy. But if you allow yourself to have dimension 5 or dimension 6 operators, you will get nucleon decay, which might signal something about the ultraviolet theory. So people do that all the time. But they never add the whole thing up, because nobody knows what the ultraviolet completion will be. Okay? So we're going to do this, following Criminelli et al. We're going to add a term which is higher derivative. So we get an extra p squared over some mass. I'll just call it m prime squared for the moment. Yes?
Capital K positive or negative?
I don't know. Believe me, I've lost track. I think my capital K was positive.
There's also some argument about the sign of this term would be completely right?
Well, it would be interesting to talk about it. I mean, I, Don't ask me about signs. Not now. However, I will discuss the sign here. There is an issue, which I think is an interesting one. Anyway, we add this. But of course, you've got to remember that there's really a box cubed over m prime squared and a box, you know, fourth over m prime sixth and so on, plus a whole bunch of higher order operators involving higher powers of the field, all of which are dropped in the decoupling limit. But you can start adding back the largest of them as you move up a little in momentum. That's what we're going to do. And we're going to pick this with this particular sign. And if we do that, then what we're going to do is say, well, if we take k squared to be much smaller than m prime squared, if you took it really much smaller, you should even drop that. But if you like go a little higher, the first thing that will pop into your theory is this, and the others will be much smaller. So we'll just keep this for a moment. And if you do that, the dispersion relation modifies itself, as I've shown. Now, you may wonder why this is not 4 vector k. The fact is, when you work it out completely, as I'll discuss in a moment, you actually get 3 vector k surviving this. It's not immediately obvious. Half of it's obvious, half of it requires 5 minutes of work. So that looks good, because that allows you to stabilize this thing. It doesn't quite do it at all wavelengths. It has instability now only at long wavelengths. In fact, you can work out the fastest rate of instability given by that. However, we would claim this is harmless if it's less than the Hubble rate. And so we do that. That puts some bounds on this. So when we solve this merged ekparotic bounce theory, we solve it subject to such a constraint, which is not hard to do. So I really wonder whether we have to do that and are not being overly conservative, but let me do it.
But yeah. So since you have higher time derivatives, you have to put more initial conditions.
Yeah, so let me do that now. So I will put it this way. Even though this, what I'm about to do, is the wrong thing to do, let us actually analyze the above dispersion relation for arbitrary k squared, but continue to drop the higher dimensional operators. That's wrong. It's like saying that you're going to take the standard model and you're now going to go way above the gut scale and you're not going to add anything back. It doesn't make any sense. But because there is a paper out there, let me do that. Let me truncate the theory, including this box phi squared term. And however, we will truncate it by dropping all the other operators. And we'll assume, as Linde does, that this h dot term is small, because otherwise it's just a mess. And we'll work in flat space, which is also what he does. And then this is more or less what was being asked. What happens is that the dispersion relation then turns into this, where I'm now keeping box instead of just the gradient piece. And as Linde et al. Show, you get 4 solutions to this, plus or minus wi, where w1 is this and w2 is that, the difference being the minus sign. And if you can look at high momentum, but that's not a problem and they don't worry about it, let's look at small spatial momentum. Their claim was, well, yes, you get exactly what these guys had. That's what cut off our dispersion relation. But you also get a high frequency solution where omega is m prime. True. And the claim is this high frequency solution corresponds to ghosts in the theory with negative energy, m prime. And if that was the entire theory, that would be true. But it's not the entire theory. We just kept the first leading term, and they're throwing away all the others. Fact is, it's decoupling from an ultraviolet theory. There's an infinite tower of operators, higher and higher power of p squared over m squared. And you have no idea what this means. This is signaled by the fact that this ghost mass, supposed ghost mass, is large. It's m prime. Whereas, in fact, the theory only makes sense when k squared is much, much less than m prime. So let me show you that you can, any day of the week, by doing the wrong thing, that is truncating a low energy theory by throwing away all its higher order operators, you'll always find ghosts, even in a grand unified theory, which is what they're doing. And I'll take an example. Well, first thing, note that that's true, but k squared is m prime squared. But the effect of theory is only valid when this is much smaller than m prime squared. If we want to take this up to m prime squared, where that supposed ghost is, we must add all the higher order operators. That's how decoupling works. But they don't want to do that. But we claim you have to do it. So let me give you a very simple example of what this all means, which was an example of Criminelli et al. It was used by Justin during Cambridge conference recently, and I'll just redo it in my own little language. Let's start with a theory, which is a grand unified theory. We have a heavy particle, chi prime, big mass, lambda, and a very light particle, phi prime, which we'll take to be massless. You will agree that there's no problem with this theory. It's got normal kinetic energy, normal mass squared in my metric. Now, let me do some field redefinitions, precisely those. And you will quickly convince yourself that you get that same theory. Now, integrate by parts here. You can then, chi can be integrated out. And this thing acts as a source. What you really have here is you're integrating out this heavy field with a source term where chi couples linearly to box phi. And we know how to integrate that out in effective field theory. And that gives you this as the theory. This is the exact theory. You actually can do the chi integral completely, and that's what you get. Now take this and Taylor expand it, and you'll get this plus this plus this plus this, because the fact is it's really the original theory. This is just another way of expressing it. And if you want to expand it, you better keep the entire series in it if you want the entire ultraviolet theory, okay? But let's not. Let's do what Linde et al. Did, which is to take this theory and now truncate this. Let's look at the truncated theory. That is, we'll throw away all the higher order things. Then I claim you can add an auxiliary field psi, integrate by parts, use the equation of motion to get that. So it's equivalent to that. And then we'll do a field redefinition. And lo and behold, we end up with a field theory which has a regular kinetic energy, a regular mass term, but has a minus, it has the wrong sign kinetic energy. It has a ghost, kinetic ghost. We started with this theory that had no ghosts in it whatsoever. It gave us a low energy theory that had no ghosts in it whatsoever. But by artificially truncating it and only keeping the leading term, all of a sudden we end up with a theory with demonstrable ghost. But if you look what the ghost frequency is, it's lambda. If I want to approach that energy, I really have to add all that infinite series back, and I'll end up with a perfectly fine theory. There's really no ghost here. It's just wrong. Okay. So there really is no ghost. It's an artifact of truncating higher dimensional operators. So that's simply true. The one thing that is interesting here is the sign of that term. We have to use a particular minus sign in order to get the dispersion relation right. If you assume that the high frequency theory is a field theory in Minkowski space with no gravity, then in fact you will at least trivially is the wrong word, but you are likely to get a plus sign and not a minus sign. And that's true. I think that's interesting. However, as pointed out even in the papers that Linde alludes to, Arkani Hamid and so on, the minute you go to non-Lorentz invariant space and gravity, that stops being the case. They don't know what to do in those circumstances, and they end their paper there. The situation here is much, much worse. This bounce phase, precisely where this issue comes up, is something where, let's say we take the M-theory view, is precisely where two brains are coming together. They're exchanging membrane instantons. Those things are becoming tensionless strings as they get close, which will have probably a continuous infinite spectrum of particles there. All the Kaluza-Klein states become massless and then become massive again, precisely in that region. Evgeny and I tried for a year and a half to try to figure out what that spectrum was, and we failed. But whatever is happening there, it's incredibly complicated. Now, that is the theory. When we go up to M prime, it's precisely that theory that this opens up to. It's not even four-dimensional anymore. It opens up to 10 or 11 dimensions. It's got this continuous infinite series of collapsing Kaluza-Klein modes. God knows what that decouples to, and there's no reason to think that we can't get the kinds of signs that we want. Is that interesting? Yes, I think that's something to think about. So let me end the talk with the reason why I think this is all so much fun, which is non-Gaussianity. And Evgeny will talk about this in detail later. I will simply tell you that within the context of what I've just shown you, we computed 3- and 4-point non-Gaussianity. And these were the results. We're looking at zeta, 3-point functions. There's this B function, which turns out to be the so-called local form in terms of the two-point amplitude. And we get exactly this result, but it has this FNL coefficient, which we can exactly compute. And it has two contributions to it in our theory. First one simply comes from the fact that there's this F function, which starts with a cubic term and goes higher. And the cubic term will, in fact, produce an FLN, which will be precisely this particular variable. Now, alpha 3 is an unspecified constant at this point. But beta, we know a lot about. I probably didn't even say in the talk, but beta tells you how fast you rolled off the top of the curve at the end of ekphorosis, and epsilon, I said, was around 1/100th in typical theory. There's also a nonlinear relation, which I don't have time to discuss here, but if any will, between the delta chi, the entropy fluctuation, and the curvature fluctuation, which contributes, even without a cubic term, its own contribution to FNL at the 3-point function. So this is the result that we get. Now, let Evgeny discuss this in more detail. I will simply point out that the typical results you get here are proportional to 1 over epsilon. In inflation, they would be proportional, slow roll inflation, to epsilon, for the reasons that Paul said. When you're slow rolling, you have essentially free theory, and you're going to essentially get a Gaussian result. We get 1 over epsilon. So even though ekphorotic theory gives the same 2-point fluctuations. In fact, in a sense, that's what ekphorotic theory is. There's two solutions to getting a Harrison Zeldovich spectrum, epsilon and 1 over epsilon, but they both give the same 2-point scale invariant result. But at higher point fluctuations, higher point correlations, they don't give the same result. They differ. Inflation is epsilon, slow roll inflation is epsilon, and ekphorosis is 1 over epsilon. So in principle, this is 1/100th. So we tend to get things of order 10 to 100 when we work this out, which is very interesting. So we get large non-Gaussianity. If we take beta to be 1, epsilon 10 to minus 1, if I pick the minus sign there, just a typical thing, if I take alpha 3 to be that, between this and that, we would find, this was initially what we did, between minus 36 and 100. However, they tend to want to be large, and this sign is simply whether you roll this way or this way. The real question is whether alpha 3 is positive or negative. We had nothing to say in our original paper about this, but what we can say is we expect to have larger values of this. So it's very easy here to find yourself between, you know, 6 and 100. It's really hard to get yourself to 0 because you have to fine tune to do that. I'm sorry.
You don't actually need to have alpha 3, I guess. It's so kind of but UF function actually does contain chi cube, doesn't it? So it's a fine tuning to actually, well, I'm talking to myself.
No. I've actually spent many nights talking to myself in the same way. I guess there's various ways, and there's one other comment I want to make too. If you didn't have this at all,
right,
you would get something. This is 1, this is 100 divided by 5, so it's like 20 plus 20. That's a typical thing, whereas inflation is 1/100 or 1,000. So there's a really a big difference there. And then you can play with this to your heart's content. And I don't think it's terrible fine-tuning to make it smaller, but it clearly is naturally larger. And I don't know if that will be the case or not. I really wish this morning I heard that it had to be, you know, positive and 10 and 100, but we'll wait 4 years to find that out. The one last comment I want to make before wrapping this. Anyway, I find this very interesting. Should it be that these kinds of FNLs are confirmed, then I think inflation, people are infinitely clever, and I'm sure there are ways to make inflation do this, as Paul was saying, but it's very natural. But if this turned out to be a thing that makes the community interested in ekpyrotic theory, then I would say the really interesting focus would be violating the null energy condition. It's a fascinating thing to do, and how to do that in an ultraviolet completion would really become very interesting in physics.
So I have another question about that. Actually, how does this prediction depend upon? So, for example, you said possibility of converting entropic violation to violation before bounds, during bounds, after bounds. How does this conclusion depend upon?
Yeah, so Paul and Lehners and others will talk about this. It's a very interesting story. The one thing I would like to point out is that we computed this essentially, but not completely, but let me say essentially assuming two exponentials, which now that gives a slightly blue tilt. However, when you go to the slightly modified potential that is at a small f function, that allows you to easily get yourself a small red tilt should you desire. And we've done the calculation, and that will not affect this result. It'll affect it at next smaller order. So that, in fact, we find no relation between the tilt being red or blue and finding large non-gas quantity of that kind. But this idea that, you know, this is only a toy of new ekpyrosis. Other people are trying other things, a lot of them having to do with late time conversion. And those are very interesting, and we'll see what these do. Thank you.
So first of all, another way to get a transition from a contracting to an expanding universe is to use a particular class of high derivative gravity theories introduced by Tirthabir Biswas, Anupam Mazumdar, and Warren Siegel. It's a very special class of high derivative gravity theories which are constructed in order to be ghost-free. So in such theories admit non-singular bounces. It's a particular class of high derivative gravity theories which are constructed to be ghost-free. And the paper is a 2005 paper by Biswas, Mazumdar, and Siegel. So now, now the second part of the comment is, if you want to take such theories without a second matter field, then we'll come to the issue, which I initially raised actually in criticism to your initial calculations. I've completely changed my mind on that. So you were saying in the talk today, one should look at the curvature perturbation zeta. So now it turns out that in non-singular bouncing models, the equation of motion for zeta has a singularity. So zeta is actually the wrong variable to focus on.
Yes.
One should focus on the metric perturbation, for example, phi, which is used to calculate microwave anisotropies. And so it turns out that you don't need a second scalar field to get a scale invariant spectrum in a single field model, which you initially had successfully through the bounds.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I think I'm, again, in keeping with the philosophy here, we just didn't want to deal with that possibility, so we needed to figures. But yeah, I think that's so if one can be happy that you go through the bounds appropriately, which you may well.
In a single field methodology case where you would say it's a global spectrum, so if you forget about the 2 points through spectrum, so for 3 points, is that large number cost indeed?
I don't know that. Do you know?
Well, we were discussing this morning,
yeah.
So I think the sense of that it is large number Gaussian.
Yeah.
I think so, just because you still have the XY phase, you have the nanometer, the 5 nanometer copper. But I haven't,
I don't have any calculations on Knox.
It would be nice. It also doesn't have to have a blue tilt. It can easily be made red with ADA, just warping this a little bit. So that's not the issue. And I don't know the answer. I guess that's still up in there.
This scenario, like the old bouncing, do I understand it right that the zeta is constant also Hubble radius, but then you get close to the phase that you're violating null energy condition, and it starts to oscillate. So,
well, what happens is that you get a contracting Hubble phase, and then it expands again. And once it expands, it's simply all these frozen fluctuations come into the horizon, begin to oscillate just as they do in inflation.
So it depends on how long the phase lasts, the space that they're inside the set.
Yes, and so there's initial value conditions that you have to discuss, which are part of that story. And we've discussed it at least. And, you know, we think that these things will go through pretty well. But, you know, you're the judge, so we'll see what the community thinks about it. I think it's...
So just before we thank Bert again, just a couple of announcements. Just thank Bert again and Nelson.